sections, the other three sections are already up there. So look through there. You can look through the other test and kind of like refresh yourself. Eric, study with that. The first group had Eaton-Lambert syndrome, which is really neat, just to give you some general ideas again. It's a autoimmune disease to your voltage-gated calcium channels in your presynaptic motor nerve terminals. So what do you think would happen with synaptic transmission? Is it going to go up? Is it going to go down? Your calcium channels aren't working. Your autoimmune disease to your voltage-gated calcium channels in your presynaptic motor nerve terminal. What's going to happen to your muscles? You can't move them, right? I know you know that. It's so straightforward that you're afraid to answer it. So the test questions weren't made to be crazy or confusing. They're meant to be kind of straightforward. And this is really weird because people do get these problems. And what do you think is going to happen? They're going to start, you know, tripping when they go up the steps, or they can't have loss of motor coordination. It's not a central problem. It's a peripheral problem. So then they end up going to the doc, and then the doc says, hey, what's wrong? Maybe it's a muscle problem. Maybe you're getting MS. Maybe, you know, something else. Maybe it is central. So they go through a whole bunch of tests, and finally they'll get down to an EMG test where they stimulate the nerve and record in the muscle, and they'll say, something's not conducting right. But if we stimulate your muscle directly, it's working pretty well. So then they realize, hey, this might be a synaptic transmission problem or MS, and they can test for all that, and they might do imaging. But it's a standard type of test. And then they find out nowadays they actually have a blood test. They can take the blood sample out and look for those antibodies for the voltage-gated calcium channels. So now it's a relatively straightforward test. But imagine a long time ago, they didn't have tests for that, right? And then they say, uh-oh, you probably have a little tumor somewhere in your body. Usually it's associated with your lungs. So then they start to image really carefully. You know, a regular image might miss it because it's so small, could be even smaller than the eraser head on your pencil. And then they start to image really carefully and they find out, oh, you got a little carcinoma on your lung somewhere. And then they go and remove it, and then you don't make the antibodies anymore. Is that not weird? That is really weird, right? Then there's other disorders that we talked about, like myasthenia gravis. And for the other group, and yours is... myasthenia gravis, where you might make antibodies to your acetylcholine receptors. And, you know, what do you think is going to happen there at the neuromuscular junction? Same kind of problems, right? But a different disorder. Or maybe you have a disorder for something else, like the third section had one on the enzyme that makes GABA, glutamate decarboxylase, GAD. So in your neurons, we're going to talk about that on tomorrow, how do you make transmitters. But one enzyme is different for glutamate to convert to GABA for your neurons. So, you know, generally we don't talk about excitatory and inhibitory transmitters, but generally GABA is inhibitory in the brain and glutamate is generally excitatory. But it's really the receptors we have to think about, right, for test. And why do I bring that up? Because GABA, actually, when you're developing as a fetus, GABA in your brain can actually be excitatory. And it is in a number of animals, even Drosophila and other animals. It's because you haven't established your equilibrium yet with chloride ions and for the plasma membrane. But in general, GABA's inhibitory. So what do you think would happen if you make an antibody to GAD, the enzymes that make GABA, or GABA receptors? If you're blocking inhibition, what do you get? Excitation, right? So what do you think would happen to that person? Muscle movements and stuff. Maybe too much contraction, right? So aren't we lucky we're not in any of those states right now that we're functioning pretty well, hopefully? So these are really some bad situations. Remember that book I told you about, Brain on Fire? Did we order it yet? No? Yes. We're going to order it this summer, right? Free reading books for the summer. Well, you remember that was an antibodies to your NMDA receptors. Your glutamate receptors, a subtype. And, hallucinations, all those kind of problems. So that situation is something else. They call this one stiff man syndrome. It should be stiff person because females can get it too, gender correct. So you can imagine stiff person syndrome, right? They go into the hospital, they can't move, they're stuck in a position. It's because they have antibodies either to their GABA receptors. And what would happen a long time ago? You know, what happened 100 years ago to these people? What do you think happened to them? Right? It's like the NMDA. They actually found people in the mental institutions that had the Brain on Fire MDMA antibodies, and they were institutionalized because nobody followed. They didn't know about checking it all the way through, but it didn't really fit the connections for what they were doing. So it's changed a lot of aspects to think about. Quite interesting. So this one's a little bit different, and you might have heard about JCD disease with other things. What else is it associated with that you might have heard of?
Mad cow disease.
Mad cow disease. And if you look up prions, right, this is part of it, but this test question didn't have anything about prions, right? So some of you might have gone off on a tangent with that, but remember, on standardized exams, you got to take the information that you get and go with it, right? If you're taking MCAT or some other type of test in other classes, if they give you this information, you go with what you got, right, first, and then you might put some extra peripheral information on there. So this prions, mad cow disease, and if you look up prion cases across the country and across the world, you know England had some of that, right? And some other places in a little island, New Guinea, right? Do you know why New Guinea had that problem?
Cannibalism
a long time ago. And it was actually a Swiss researcher that figured this out. Actually, they were eating the brains of other people. Kind of gross, right? But then Kentucky's on the list. Why is Kentucky on the list for prion disease? Not so much anymore, but it was, and it's still a concern that they look at. Any reasons that you can think of? Kentucky is on that list. We're on the list for so many things, like the number two for pancreatic cancer, number two, or number one for COPD, and all kinds of things due to smoking, primarily. But why are we also on the list for prion disease? Anybody in eastern Kentucky? Is there anything that you would do with squirrels, that some people do with squirrels? Some of the maybe more rambunctious people that would kill a squirrel, and what do they do with it sometimes? Okay, all right. I mean, I've had squirrel meat when I was a kid before, but in eastern Kentucky, there are some groups that actually take the brain out of the squirrel and mix it with fried eggs. And so they have scrambled eggs with squirrel brain. That squirrel brain has prions. And they got this disease, too, the mad cow disease, basically. So this is why Kentucky's on that list. Yikes. In some countries, like in France, they actually eat sheep brains. It's not uncommon. It's gross stuff. But anyways, it's probably very fat. It's probably like biting into butter. But, you know, people do eat brains in different places. But this one's a little different, right? So what you've been given here was the autoantibody to your voltage-gated potassium channels, right? And it could be a lot of different problems. But what do you think would happen if you don't have voltage-gated potassium channels working right? What's going to happen? Depolarize the cells. What brings it back down? Voltage-gated potassium channels, right? So a lot of mess up in how your nervous system's going to function, right? And this gentleman probably needs... What's the last name again?
Skeeter.
Skeeter. And so, let's see if I can find your thing here. Yes. So that's... You could have gone off on a lot of different tangents. So you probably got some points for this one way or another. And I was basically getting your brain juices flowing so you could, you know, get some... things going for you. Mm-hmm. Okay, let me find this little mouse. I don't have a mouse anymore. Okay. So figure 7 here, this was straight out of the that web page with the neurophysiology stuff that we had. And in below, this was the question that's a little different. So, something was a giveaway here. I had it covered up, but it slipped off when I did the printing. This was supposed to be covered. And then, but then I thought, uh-oh, I just gave it to everybody. Synaptic facilitation. So, facilitation is what? Facilitate something. Enhance it, right? But facilitation is more than additive. So, this is not... temporal or spatial summation. If you repetitively stimulate this, boom, boom, right? And if it was temporal summation, which could happen here, and some of you might have added that, temporal summation is just summing, right? adding the two responses together. If you had on the other class, we had two responses, like one here and one here, and we stimulated the two together, and they were recorded on the nerve. What would that be? Spatial summation, right? Two spaces, the dendrites coming together, graded responses, going to the cell body, you measure it, it's a spatial summation. This could be temporal, but it's not really temporal because this is two times the amplitude of that. What does this relate to? It could be presynaptic. Remember, everything with synapses is divided up pre and post, right? Now, could it be LTP? But LTP was repetitive stimulation. Remember, AMPA receptors had to come up into the membrane. That takes a good amount of time, not the one stimulus. But I know we might have given you some partial credits on those. But this is STF, short-term facilitation because of residual calcium, right? This is that residual calcium hypothesis that Bernard Katz worked on in the 1950s, which is a form of memory, right? It knows what happened before. So here's an alternate question I think one of the other sections had. Can't remember if I did it in this year or not. What if you put a chelator inside of the nerve terminal to chelate calcium? A chelator can bind, you know, the substance, right? So if you put a substance injected into the axon which chelates calcium, and you repeated this experiment, would you get as much STF, short-term facilitation? Probably not, right? So these are the kind of things to think about, just to integrate the concepts together. All right. Okay, so this was, I was hoping to give you, and I gave, tried to give as much partial credit as I could on this, rise tau and decay tau. So if you raise up, you know, you have a rising tau, remember 63% gave you the whole figure here, but why is it when you would go down, it might not be the same tau? It might be longer, it might be shorter. What do you do when you depolarize a cell? You could potentially, open up other channels. You could potentially open up a potassium channel, maybe a calcium channel. And that's going to change, that's going to be different than the rise and then the decay, right? So this is why they separate out decay tau and rise tau, is because they can understand what's going on with that membrane when you depolarize it. And you can even think of the opposite direction, hyperpolarize. There are some channels that open up when you hyperpolarize a cell. And that's really important because that's how some of your heart functions, actually. So it's kind of interesting later on. We'll talk about that. So the decay tau could be shorter, could be longer, but it could be due to changes in, what is tau equal to? R times C, right. So C probably doesn't change much capacitance, but R could change by having more channels open or closed, right? So kind of think about that. Okay, so we had this on old exams too and things like this, but and some of you might, you know, have used one of these other ones. But if you have all of a sudden a cell that poke holes in it and allow sodium and potassium to go across the membrane, it's going to go to zero. There's no potential. There's no equilibrium potential anymore. It's just zero, right? There's no potential left. It's zero. So that's what happens if you open up and poke holes inside of the membrane. So if some of you chose sodium equal, you know, a new equilibrium potential for sodium, well, then it could have been a new equilibrium for potassium too, right? But the best answer here is a zero because there is no potential left. So sometimes this kind of question, think about this one. This is the type of question sometimes you're going to get if you go on to professional schools or nursing or other things, or MCAT maybe, the best answer, right? And I didn't mean it to be tricky, but if you chose a sodium potential, then you should have equally chosen a potassium potential, new potassium potential. But then you'd realize, something's a little fishy with this. So let's think about this again. Oh, no potential is the idea here, right? Okay, so we're good with that? Okay. Now, this one. Goldman-Hutchinson cats and the nurse equation. Anybody get the tattoo yet for extra credit? No one got the tattoo? All right. You just don't want to show me this tattoo? Okay. The Nernst equation, Goldman-Hutchinson-Katz equation, you definitely want to have that down pat, all right? Have that down pat. And you need to know what happens. So if your potassium, it's like your experiment that you did in the lab. You raised potassium. What happened to your resting membrane potential when you raised potassium? Did the cell hyperpolarize or depolarize? Hopefully we remember. Depolarize, right? So if you raise potassium outside, it depolarizes. How important is that? Did we talk about that already, right? Raise potassium up. We talk about what happens if you go into the ER and your potassium levels are off? No? We never did that? Did we say anything about that? We didn't tell the other class. I forgot to tell them. So potassium is so... We'll talk about this when we get to osmoregulation, too. It is so critical in your body to keep that potassium in that window. And we're going to memorize... We're actually going to memorize those values for us. Just to make you remember something about yourselves, too. If it goes above too high... Well, you depolarize the cells. Most likely, you're going to have arrhythmia and die from something like that. But also, if it goes too high, your nervous system's not going to work, right? Because everything's depolarized. If it's too low, you got a problem. So, you have a confusion. You're in the ER. What happens? They're going to take a blood sample. They're going to measure your electrolytes really quick. A little plus-plus sign, maybe a little red line, is going to show if you're above 5 milliequivalents per milliliter. Whatever the values they might show in that reading. And then they're going to worry about that right away. So what's going to happen? They're going to bring your potassium down. Put an IV in you. Start to flush that out. But if it's really too high and you're in arrhythmias and your brain's going to start shutting down, they're going to get that potassium out of you really quick. We didn't talk about that yet in class? Okay. So what they can do is they, I know this sounds gross, but they'll put a resin up your behind, basically, in your large intestine called cacale. And what that does is it sucks the potassium out of your blood into that resin, and you poop it out, and they'll put another batch up there, but it saves your life, right? Because you can't have that potassium up too high too long. So cacalate is this resin that they use, but otherwise you're going to die. So what happens if you depolarize the cell gradually and it stays up? What happens to the voltage-gated sodium channels? They stay in an inactive state, right? They have to come back down to rest for a certain amount of time. So you're like an absolute refractor period the whole time. Really bad situation, right? So that's why that's so critical. That's why potassium levels are so critical. All right, so you get the idea of why we're emphasizing this too. Okay, what makes up the bilipid membrane? I've tried to give as much partial credit as I could here. This goes back to the fluid mosaic model, which they won the Nobel Prize for as well. But if you think about that bilipid membrane, it's just not the bilipid, but what else is in the membrane in the cell? Proteins, receptors, channels, right? All this stuff is inside. Cholesterol. So lots of things are in that bilipid membrane, right? And so that's one thing. And then the other part was about fluidity of the membrane. And we talked about this a zillion times. But basically, if you took butter and you took it from room temperature and put it in the oven, it becomes more fluid, right? How could the animal bring that back down to a homeostatic level where it's not over liquidified? Increase cholesterol, right? How do you make it tighter? Get rid of the unsaturated and have saturated, right? And if you had different carbon chain lengths, get them all the same so you have a nice interaction, right? So make sure you write those things down to have that down pat. And hopefully this was a gimme. Homeostasis. I think some people, it might have been this class or the other one, because I think I had the same question the other one, listed one but not the other. So you got one point off. Okay, the quantum, we know what a quantum is due to, right? A single vesicle fusing, right? Gives rise to the minis, the spontaneous events, the synaptic transmission. Okay, and then you could have gone off on lots of tangents with this. Give three examples of something that was done that helps us humans in understanding simpler animals. Some people, I think, only gave two examples. Gave two examples, but you could have used the examples you had in your lab, right? You did a frog prep. You did a crayfish neuromuscular junction, but we talked about the squid. We talked about the cockroach. Tons of examples, right? So I know you might have had test anxiety or something, and maybe that was a problem. August Croak principle. Some things you got to remember, right? August Croak, we've mentioned that. There's a animal that you could use that's a really good model, accentuated model, to understand the physiological process, right? Examples, squid. Example, another one we talked about in class is desert kangaroo rat, you know, because it uses metabolic water. We even talked about the cockroach for understanding acetylcholine receptors. You know, lots of things. Frog neuromuscular junction was a really good one for looking at synaptic transmission. Same with the crayfish. All right. These, you know, we had that PowerPoint on the terminology of these, right? Adaptation, acclimation, acclimatization. And sometimes people got these confused. They might have wrote it out completely, and I might have just give you partial credit or something there. Okay. Passive diffusion, I think one person missed this. Passive means it doesn't need ATP, right? And glycolysis takes place. Cell cytoplasm, right? Okay. And we didn't torture you by trying to figure out how many ATP made in TCA, electron transport chain, but glycolysis in general. Remember, this could be a trick question if you reword it. The total number of ATP made in glycolysis is 4 total. Net, 2, right? So it's kind of interesting. Don't get confused. On some standardized exams, they actually do a net versus a total, and you get too much in the mindset that it's just the 2. So watch out how they might word that. Okay. So some people got confused with this one. And since not everybody can see the board, I'll just do it with my hand. So, and hopefully I wrote on everybody's exams. Took a little while to grade 100 exams with essays, but anyways. And so you give two stimuli, you get this graded response, right? And if it came down quickly with the first one, when you gave the second one and it came down, you basically haven't summed at all. But if you had a longer tau, stimulate one, and it comes down before when you stimulate the next one, you're still riding on the tail of the first one, and you can have a higher summation, right? So which one's more likely to reach threshold with how your nervous system works? Temporal or spatial summation, right? It's going to be the one with the longer tau, right? Okay. What does the resting membrane potential, why does the resting membrane potential increase, become less negative when the bath around the crayfish muscle was exchanged with saline containing a higher potassium? So this was an open response question. Basically, some people just said it depolarized, but that's not the rationale why, right? Because we already gave you, it became less negative, right? So you could say it changed that value on the Nernst equation in the membrane's permeable potassium, and we had a higher value on the out over the in, so the equilibrium potential goes up, it less negative, more depolarized. Sometimes you might have just said changed. And remember, your TAs hopefully told you to be really careful with just writing change. You got to have the direction of change, right? So it depolarized because the membrane's permeable with potassium, and this is what happens. And we just told you why that's so critical of an experiment. Okay, so some of this, a few people missed this. Transmembrane channel, predominantly positive charged amino acids will allow what? If it's positive, it's going to repel the other positive and allow chloride, right? So that's the idea with that. Okay. Some people miss this one. And maybe, you know, test anxiety and stuff. But try to think about that action potential, the different parts, right? What happens right here? Threshold. Voltage-gated sodium channels open up, right? Boom. Depolarized. I think on the other class I asked, why does the action potential not go to E-sodium? What are the two main reasons it doesn't go to E-sodium? Anybody remember two main reasons the peak of your action potential doesn't go to E-sodium? One, what happens to the sodium channels after they open? They inactivate, and potassium channels open, and so that's going to counteract the sodium, so that's why, number three, it goes towards E-sodium, but it doesn't reach E-sodium. So then, the same idea, sodium channel is inactivated. What's making the cell membrane come back down? The gradient to E-potassium. Potassium channels are open. So it's trying to go to what? E-potassium, which is down here, number 5, right? So E-potassium, it's not up here, it's going to be where it's going to. And then, what opened those potassium channels? The depolarization. but you're not depolarized anymore. So what happens? They start to close. And then the membrane, if you don't have those voltage-gated potassium channels open, what's the membrane doing in the meantime? Sodium-potassium pump's kicking in. It's going back to rest. All right? So that's what's happening there. Okay, red blood cell. Hypo means low osmolarity, right? So you're taking a red blood cell, you put it in distilled water, what's going to happen? Water goes into it, swells, expands, pops. What if you take red blood cell and you put it into seawater? It's more osmotic, higher osmotic, it's going to shrink, right? Right, because water's going to go out of the cell. Okay, I know some people got confused with this one, but we went over it in class a bit too. And this is a channel that's not inactivating, right? So you depolarize it and it says closed and open, but you have a patch electrode on the membrane. So what you see here is different units. One unit, two units, three units. So three channels at max, right? And if it stays depolarized, they might open, close, open, close, open, close. So the other class, we've had a question about why was patch clamp so important that it won these people a Nobel Prize to understanding patch clamping? It's so you could understand the individual kinetics of channels, their open time, how much current goes through a channel, the types of ions that go through a channel. You could then look at pharmacology, which drugs work on certain channels. So this patch clamping technique was very important for understanding how channels and how cells work, not just in neurons, but throughout your whole body, like your heart as well. Some people just drew a blank on this one, I know. Sorry. Metabolic water, right? Desert kangaroo wrap. Okay, on this one, how does the cell get energy in the form of ATP from fats and lipids compared to glucose? And metabolic pathways used for fat proteins as compared to glucose? So what I was just trying to... Maybe you answered the first part and you forgot the second part. Remember when you get essays, you always circle different parts. So I think most people forgot the protein part. But let's just go through the general scenario. All we were looking for was... And we said we don't have to memorize all the different pathways, but fats are broken down through the fatty acid cycle and go into the TCA cycle, and then electron transport chain. Glucose, as you know, glycolysis, TCA, electron transport chain. Proteins, what do? They're broken down into amino acids, and those amino acids can enter in the TCA cycle in different places. Some of you might have had that in biochem, so you might have, you know, a bit more emphasis on that. In biochem, I think they torture you, maybe, or at least they used to, which amino acids entered where in the TCA cycle, like glutamate versus aspartate and all kinds of things, and you had to figure out ATP. So that would have been crazy, right? But we're not into that. All right, some people got confused with this question a little bit. The rate of glycolysis in the Krebs cycle is regulated not to break down all the glucose stores at once in the cell. So inside your cell, that was the key. Some of you went off on a tangent, that's okay, on insulin and glucagon. We'll cover all that later when we get to endocrine. But we're talking about in the cell right now. So you have glucose in the cell. Why is it not all broken down at once? Remember that one slide? Feedback mechanisms, right? ADP can actually stimulate some of those enzymes. ATP actually can come back and do negative feedback on those enzymes in the TCA cycle and actually regulate the speed of those enzymes working. And there were different places we had on that figure where they get this negative feedback and some positive kind of responses too. So if ADP is too high, that actually stimulated enzymes to enhance ATP production. Okay. So just negative feedback within the cell, enzymes back into the TCA cycle, or whatever we covered there. What factors, protein structure, primary, secondary, tertiary, quaternary? Some got a little confused with the last two. Primary, you know, amino acids going across. Simple protein structure, linear structure. Secondary, beta sheets, alpha, you know. Tertiary is basically folding of the protein, but also you could have cysteine-cysteine, disulfide bonds that could actually then make that a lot stronger. So wherever you are in that one. And then quaternary, the example was hemoglobin, multiple globular proteins together giving that structure. And ion channels discriminate between ions of the same charge. So I know this one might have been a little hard, but we covered some of this that's interesting about ions of the same charge. So sodium potassium, let's think of that. What's different about sodium potassium right off the bat? different size, right? And the other thing, so you might have got that part, but you could have even maybe listed about something about the channel being discriminatory, about the size of the channel and charge on the channel, and try to give you credit. But also the hydration sphere changes not just the size of the ion, but the size that would go through that pore. So the amount of water that goes around the potassium or sodium changes its overall properties too. And as I mentioned in class, that some people, I know you probably don't want to go into biophysics, but some people spend their whole life studying nothing but ion channels and how much energy it would take, actually in some cases, to strip off the water molecules so an ion could go through the channel. And that's actually important too, because if you didn't have that energy, you couldn't do that, right? So there's lots of things we could have gone off into a tangent with this. Remember, I think I forgot to tell you at the beginning of the test that you had 107 points on the test, right? So that was already buffered in for your bonus points, basically. You had 107. I didn't care where it came from. It wasn't the last question or the first question. And then we just took points off from 107. Class average was, anybody remember? 82, basically, right? So not bad. All right. Are we on this one already?
Yes.
And this one was just to look at the graphs and try to understand what was going on in this pretty little bird that's in here. And you can see that it's respirometry here. Some of you did a little bit more than others, and I was here to help answer any questions. But there's three things here on this figure. One was the first number, the second number, and the third number. So we're going down first, second, third, and then we're looking across with temperature. So what's happening here as the temperature, let's just look at this one during the day. It's the metabolic rate is what? 715, 604, 507, 494. Whoa. The higher the temperature, metabolic rate went down. So that's all we had to really read across there. Why is metabolic rate going down? That's kind of interesting, right? So it gets too hot. What do you do on a real hot day? Do you go out and, I mean, when it's really super hot, do you go out and exercise? You're going to get heat stroke, right? So what do? You kind of shut down, right? Stay still. Maybe fan yourself, right? So it's the same idea. These birds will go into this state of inactivity to try to reduce metabolic rate, right? And so that's kind of interesting. And then as you go down from daylight to night to torpor, and remember, we defined the torpor there. The torpor is a state of inactivity. And so they're decreasing their metabolic rate as they go from into the state of torpor, which is also like going to high temperatures to not be active. Another word while we're on this right now, we'll cover it towards the end of the course, is estivation. So you heard of hibernation, right? A little squirrel goes into the ground and hibernates, shuts down in the cold, and the point is, a bear doesn't hibernate, really? Not a true hibernator? Why is that not a true hibernator? That's sometimes on standardized exams in a case. Why would a big bear, hint, big bear, not be a true hibernator? Where the body temperature is going to drop. Compared to some smaller animals, like some squirrels, are true hibernators. Where their body temperature drops and their metabolic rate drops. Why do you think there would be a difference? Why are bears not true hibernators, but it's used as a common expression, like bears hibernate, but they're not true hibernators in the biological sense? What could you think about?
Could they have to feed the cubs?
Pardon?
Could they have to feed the cubs?
It's got to feed the cubs. Well, yes, kind of. This is winter time, but let's say, what do we think about with size? Volume to surface ratio for homeotherms. How long is it going to take a bear to warm back up compared to a little squirrel? See the problem? So the problem is, this is why they think that bears are really not, the bigger the animals, they're not really a true hibernator, because it takes too long to warm up and cool down, and if something, a predator came in, it couldn't react, right? It would take too long to warm the body back up. So squirrels are really, some of the squirrels are really true hibernators, because they can drop their body temperature, but they can raise it back up quicker, smaller body surface, and you know, all that good stuff. All right. So that was that question. I think the last one then was the idea of the quantal hypothesis and synaptic transmission. So the key was here, synaptic transmission, quantal hypothesis, how do they do these general experiments? So it was how to. Some people went off and said, you know, he measured a mini but that doesn't tell you how he did the experiments, really. So the ideas were, you know, he recorded in a neuron, arm muscle fiber, basically muscle fibers, in the frog neuromuscular junction. He also worked on crayfish, your favorite prep. But he recorded in the muscle fiber, and he recorded spontaneous events. He measured the amplitude of those spontaneous events, right? He plotted the amplitude of these spontaneous events. He got a distribution, right? So you could have drawn out that distribution like we did in class on the overhead projector. And then he looked at stimulating the nerve terminal while he recorded in the muscle, but he used high magnesium or low calcium or maybe cadmium to decrease the amount of vesicles that would fuse. Or he used the postsynaptic drug, what was it that we said in class? Karari, right? And he could poison the acetylcholine receptors. The point was he would stimulate the nerve and cause the muscle to depolarize, but sub-threshold, so he wouldn't get an action potential in the muscle fiber. He looked at all those different evoked responses. Evoked means you stimulate the nerve. Evoked responses, measured the amplitude of all these evoked responses, plotted that in the histogram, and he saw these different bumps, basically, if he looked at it, different distributions. The average difference between those different distributions was the same as the amplitude of the minis. So then he said, oh, evoke release must be some kind of packets that relates to these minis that he could record without stimulating, right? And around 0.5 millivolts in his papers and that we've covered. So then he postulated before they did AEM, before they knew there were vesicles, that transmitter must be released in packets, because it was a unitary increase with the evoked responses, and that unitary increase matched your minis. Okay, we're going to go through that again sometime in lecture with little whiteboards, and we're going to draw that out, make sure that we got that down, because that's the fundamental principles of how your brain works, how your neuromuscular junctions work, how every animal that has a nervous system and synapses work, you know, in the whole world, right? So it's something that important that we really need to make sure we get that down. Okay, so that's it on this.